Welcome to Hub Dialogues, a podcast that celebrates the big thinkers and bold ideas that are driving the public conversation. On Hub Dialogues, you'll hear the Hub's editor-at-large, Sean Spear, in conversation with some of the world's sharpest minds and brightest thinkers about the issues and ideas that they're passionate about and that they think we should spend more time focusing on. The Hub's podcasts are generously supported by listeners like you. Visit thehub.ca to enroll now as a free member. Members get access to the Hub's best content and analysis, including original news reporting, commentary, and yes, lots more podcasting. Visit now, www.thehub.ca.
Welcome to Hub Dialogues. I'm your host, Sean Spear, editor-at-large at The Hub. This is a special episode of Hub Dialogues in which I speak with the authors of two books up for this year's Donner Book Prize. In the first half of the show, you'll hear me in conversation with international lawyer Michael Byers and astrophysicist Aaron Boley about their book, Who Owns Outer Space? International Law, Astrophysics, and the Sustainable Development of Space. In the second half, I'll speak with McGill University law professor Ignacio Cafone about his book, The Privacy Fallacy, Harm and Power in the Information Economy. As I mentioned, both books have recently been shortlisted for the prestigious Donner Book Prize for the best public policy book by a Canadian. Hub Dialogues is honored to speak with the five finalists between now and the award day. The next voice you'll hear is mine, in conversation with Michael Byers and Aaron Boley, and then Ignacio Cafone. Michael and Aaron, thanks for joining us at Hub Dialogues, and congratulations on the book and its success.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The book's key thesis is that we've had a form of global governance for outer space for some time, but that we cannot take it for granted. Let's start with the current model. What is the Outer Space Treaty, and what's its significance?
So the Outer Space Treaty was negotiated in 1967, with the two lead negotiators being the United States and the Soviet Union. So it's a Cold War treaty. But neither of those contesting superpowers wanted the Cold War to extend into space. So it's an arms control treaty, and it's a treaty that seeks to keep space peaceful and cooperative. A lot has happened since 1967, but the Outer Space Treaty is essentially a constitution for outer space that sets out some really important principles, such as the fact that nation states are responsible for their private corporations and their activities in space. It sets out a duty to rescue astronauts wherever they might be. It prohibits the deployment of nuclear weapons in space. It's a pretty amazing treaty, especially when you consider the context in which it was negotiated. And it provides a solid foundation for moving forward. But there's a second point to Aaron and my book, which is that the rapid expansion of humanity into space today, although it's wonderful, also carries all kinds of unforeseen risks. And so part of good governance is identifying risks, taking measures to prevent them or to mitigate them, that we can't get caught up in a gold rush mentality. We have to develop space in a responsible way.
And then to build on what Michael was saying, the principles in the Outer Space Treaty are done in such a way that as our activities and our reach in outer space expands, that they can set the foundation for how we understand our actions and activities in space and how we move forward with that. So in that sense, it is also very important for setting, you know, the base for how we move forward in space. For the second part that Michael was noting, we have an Earth space system. And as we expand into space, there are risks that affect both our continued use and exploration of outer space, as well as activities on Earth. And in the kind of buildup to the Outer Space Treaty, we had already seen, you know, actions that had taken place in outer space that led to some of the framing of the provisions in the Outer Space Treaty, such as Article 9. And this is in reference to the launch of the Westford Needles and the reaction of astronomers to that.
I gather, Michael and Aaron, there's some debate in legal and policy circles about how to interpret the principle of national appropriation in the Outer Space Treaty, including, for instance, whether a national government could establish some form of property rights over the natural resources on the moon, or even possibly a permanent moon settlement. Talk about these debates, and more importantly, to the point raised by both of you, if we want to move beyond the context in which the Outer Space Treaty was established, do we need a new international agreement, or are we able to account for some of these new developments within the treaty itself?
Well, that's a very topical question, and that there are a lot of states and companies interested in, for instance, the existence of water ice on the moon that could be used to make fuel or make oxygen to support people living there. And the simple answer is that if you go through a careful interpretation of the Outer Space Treaty, you realize that the issue of commercial space mining was left for another day, that it wasn't dealt with in the treaty because there was no need to deal with it in the 1960s.
Sure.
And so what we have now are different countries seeking to advance their interests by developing law in different contexts, in different ways, with different allies. So, for instance, you have the United States bringing together its allies through the development of something called the Artemis Accords, which is designed to support commercial space mining. And you have Russia and China, the other two great spacefaring powers, saying, no, actually, we need to negotiate this multilaterally at the United Nations. So there is a contestation right now as to the appropriate venue to do this. But that doesn't mean that anyone has abandoned the foundational principles. The United States still says that the Artemis Accords are in accordance with the Outer Space Treaty. So there's no conflict here. It's just an ongoing negotiation as different players, you know, compete to push the negotiations into a forum that's advantageous to them. So I guess I'll close with that point. There is no conflict in space. No country has ever used a weapon against another country's satellite. No country has egregiously violated the Outer Space Treaty. And all countries still, even with the war in Ukraine, come together in a multilateral context like the United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space to talk to each other, to negotiate. And I've actually suggested in some of my own work on my own that space and other extreme environments are different from most of international relations, that these cold, dark, dangerous places force cooperation between countries.
Yeah, and it's not just property rights when we're thinking about the appropriation as well. When we look at what's happening with proliferated satellite systems, particularly the large-scale Omega constellations, where they occupy very large swaths of Earth orbital region at high densities, then you start having conflicts with other operators. And that leads to then questions over whether that use, that occupation of those orbital slots are a form of appropriation. And the answer to address this is the multilateral work and negotiations to continue forward and to prevent any single entity from utterly dictating what happens in Earth's orbital space.
In addition to some of the big picture questions that we've already been discussing, Michael and Aaron, what are some of the immediate practical ones that we must confront when it comes to the laws of outer space? What, for instance, does it mean for space tourism or the deployment of satellites or other increasingly commonplace spatial activities?
Well, just to take space tourism, there is a question as to whether the duty to rescue astronauts extends to tourists. And again, one has to go back and do an interpretation of the Outer Space Treaty and the rescue agreement that was negotiated a year later. And Aaron and I take the view in our book that this obligation is a humanitarian obligation. It's designed to save human life, and to arbitrarily draw a line between an astronaut and someone who's not an astronaut but in space would actually deny the purpose of these agreements. But that needs to be accepted multilaterally, that if there are tourists in space and something goes wrong, their spacecraft loses propulsion, for instance, that if another operator has a spacecraft in that area that could rescue them, that there's actually a duty to abandon your own mission and go and save those people. So that's an example of how you could get states to explicitly state what we think is already implicit. But there are lots of other issues. You know, one of the issues that Aaron's already touched on is that some operators like SpaceX are launching thousands and thousands of satellites. And although they need to coordinate their use of radio frequency through the International Telecommunication Union, at the moment there's no limitation on numbers. And so they've adopted a consumer electronic product model to space, where they build lots of satellites very cheaply. They only operate them for 5 years, and then they replace them. And so you have a constant cycle of replacement of thousands and thousands of satellites, which is bad for space debris. It's bad for the atmosphere, because when they re-enter the atmosphere, they don't disappear. They just turn into millions of particles in the upper atmosphere. So there are all these negative consequences that come from this mass production approach. And, you know, we think that the countries need to come together and say, look, you know, we can't just treat space the way we used to treat the ocean. It's not unlimited. You know, today we know that we shouldn't dump plastic in the ocean. We need to take a forward-looking approach to space and say, maybe we need to cap the number of satellites. Maybe we need to require that companies build satellites that last for longer than 5 years. Those are difficult discussions to have. And Aaron and I are deliberately provocative, because we don't work for a space company. We don't work for a government to say, look, you have to treat this as an environment that has limited carrying capacities, and you need to act responsibly.
Our actions have large implications for the outer space environment as well as the Earth environment. And humanity, time and time again, takes the position that things are just too big for us to care about. And as Michael already said, that this is true with the oceans and it's true with the atmosphere, and we're doing it again. And it's something that we really need to draw attention to. Now, we very much recognize and rely on the services that are provided by satellites. Satellites improve society when used correctly. And so a lot of the analysis that goes into the book is trying to understand, you know, what happens when we're not using and exploring space in a responsible way. What are those risks? Finding those boundaries so we could better understand how to move forward in the most responsible way. You know, there is a big difference between saying, okay, yes, we should have this constellation of satellites in order to connect the world. Absolutely. But do you need tens of thousands of satellites in order to do that? And what happens when every state decides that they want tens of thousands of satellites in order to fulfill a particular niche of that problem? And so this is where cooperation needs to come in, and this is where we do need to understand what the limits are. And for the other analyses that were put into the book, you know, this bears to the question of, you know, astronomy and whether astronomy is a form of the use and exploration of outer space. And so this is something we dive into the book, because there is a conflict between, or a potential conflict between, the proliferation of satellites and the exploration of outer space from ground-based observatories. And so the question of whether astronomy is the use or exploration of space is just a question that hasn't really, you know, mattered before. But now, when there is satellites that are causing lots of interference with observations from the ground, now it's something that can matter. And so this is another one of the aspects of the legal analysis that was done in the book.
And if I could just add to that very briefly, the use and exploration of space is protected in the Outer Space Treaty. So companies have the right, countries have the right under the Outer Space Treaty to launch satellites. It's a use and exploration of space. The question is whether there's a competing use and exploration of space in the form of astronomical observations from telescopes. And if you have two competing rights, then you need to balance them. So that's why it's important.
So it's not just a matter of the company deciding to have mitigation efforts because they think it's a nice thing to do. There's actually a requirement then for a state to ensure that in their authorization and supervision of that company, that they are preserving the space environment, including for ground-based astronomy.
Let me put a penultimate question to you, Aaron. In your last answer, you talked a bit about managing risk. And of course, Michael said out at the opening that the Outer Space Treaty was born out of the context of the Cold War. As you look ahead, what are today's risks of war in space and how can we best mitigate them?
The biggest risk of war in space is space actors deciding that they're not worried about the creation of millions of pieces of space debris. So with regards to responsible space actors like the United States and China, they're not going to start blowing up each other's satellites because they would hurt themselves. They would end up creating debris that would take out their own satellites. So there's a real situation of mutually assured destruction that ensures that responsible, significant actors behave themselves. The Chinese, for instance, don't want space debris because they have their own space station. They don't want to lose their space station because someone blew up a satellite. So the problem comes with actors who are not responsible acquiring the capability to blow up someone else's satellite. So think of Vladimir Putin on a bad day, maybe not acting rationally. Or think of Kim Jong-un, the dictator of North Korea, who is developing the capacity to launch satellites. So when I worry about the breakout of some kind of armed conflict in space, I look to the powerful actors. I look to China to tell Putin to behave himself. I look to China to tell North Korea to behave itself. I look at a general recognition multilaterally that there are some things you just don't do. Just like we've had the ability, remarkably, to avoid nuclear war for what, 75 years now. And that's because people have said, look, the risks here are too big. And so when people realize that you know, this is not sci-fi, you don't blow stuff up for fun. It's not just about, you know, being cool and having a military, that it's actually about actions having consequences and those consequences impacting our own economies, our own security, our own way of life. The stakes are so high in Earth orbit that so far countries are behaving themselves.
And further operation in outer space, just the difficulty of that helps to foster the cooperation. It's likely that there's going to be some failure of some pretty critical infrastructure, and there will be reliance on other states to help out. And so as we build infrastructure that sees us going to, say, the moon, it has to be in a cooperative environment. And there are physical realities that really prevent people from completely going alone. Now, there are independent programs that are being developed, and we're seeing that with the Artemis program. And then we also have a separate Chinese program that's moving forward. And both of these programs are making great advances in the use of the exploration of the moon. But we are going to reach a very hard reality when the operations really start moving in earnest on the moon, in which there's going to be hard physical realities that require then the cooperation. And in order to maintain that cooperation, we're going to have to see in the governance regime, then the sharing of information and, of course, and maintaining to those foundations of the Outer Space Treaty that we had talked about before.
That's a great segue, Aaron, to my final question. How do we renew the model of global governance that the book documents in such great detail?
Well, I'll just say as many people as possible need to read the book. And
buy the book, Michael, not just read it.
Well, actually, more than that, the book is freely available. You can download the entire PDF for free. And Aaron and I used one of our research grants to pay a big open access fee so that young people around the world can read this book, sure. That people from the global south can read this book, because it's absolutely important that the general public and future experts, future leaders understand these issues and understand that it's possible to be both excited about the development of space and conscious that we need to do so responsibly, that this isn't just about enthusiasm for space. It's about enthusiasm for doing it right.
That's right.
And doing it right means that you need to understand the science, you need to understand the law, you need to understand the political and economic dynamics, that this can't be a Wild West. It needs to be a collaborative, regulated environment. And there's reason, there's significant reason for hope.
And it's not just understanding each of those elements that Michael just articulated. It's also understanding how they're interconnected and knowing how, you know, trying to address one problem affects other problems. And it might not be in a positive way. It's a matter of talking about this excitement and the possibilities of space exploration and the use of outer space, and recognizing that it is something that we have to work at to ensure that it is done responsibly and safely.
That's a great spot to end our conversation. The book, as Michael and Aaron said, can be accessed, available online. It's called Who Owns Outer Space? International Law, Astrophysics, and the Sustainable Development of Space. Michael and Aaron, thank you so much for joining us at Hub Dialogues.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Hi, Hub Podcast listeners. Maybe you've seen in this very same podcast feed a new program called Hub Headlines. It features the best analysis and thinking of our writers each and every morning. It's delivered to you in a convenient audio format in this podcast feed. All you have to do is click and download. Instead of reading Sean Spear, Howard Englund, Ginny Roth, any one of the terrific writers contributing to the Hub each daily, you can listen to them on the go. It's convenient. It's built for people like you with busy lives. If you're multitasking, if you enjoy the Hub but can't get on a screen, check out Hub Headlines. We've got you covered with the audio version of the Hub's best commentary and analysis each day. Again, you can grab this all on the same podcast feed that you are listening to this program now. Simply download each morning Hub Headlines and enjoy our best analysis and insights.
Ignacio, thanks for joining us at Hub Dialogues, and congratulations on the book and its success.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me here. I'm excited to talk about this with you.
Let's start from the beginning. What are some of the basic assumptions of our current legal privacy regime that you describe in the book as the, quote, traditionalist approach? And how has the rise of the internet and data-driven businesses come to challenge those assumptions?
So the underlying assumption in many, if not most, of the protection mechanisms that we have is that people are engaging in consumer-like interactions with those entities that hold their data. So in a similar way that I can go to a store, buy a pair of shoes or a sweater, and I give some money and I leave with whatever good I buy with that money, our protection systems assume that we engage with data companies one by one and we give them more data. And in exchange, we get products and services, sometimes for free, sometimes at a reduced price. And that assumption worked when this basic mechanism was designed in the 80s and 90s, but it doesn't work anymore because of the internet and particularly because of AI. Today, our data interactions happen second by second without our knowledge because data is how we interact with each other, how we socialize, how we engage with the economy. And the consequence of those interactions, unlike the consequence of buying a pair of shoes or a sweater, stay with us forever because our information is linked to us in a way that our money is not. So after we give information to a company or to a government, that information, unlike money that we may give, can have consequence for us in the long run and can have social consequence for the people around us as well in ways that it's impossible for us to anticipate.
That's a great setup. You distinguish between the experience of purchasing shoes from a retail store and interacting on one of these web platforms. Let's just take up that specific point. What are the differences? How should we understand what you have come to describe as the consent illusion?
So there are, I think, three important differences. The first is inferences. Before AI, but increasingly because of AI, the information that is risky for us and the information that is profitable for companies is not the information that we give them, but the things that they infer about us based on that information. So you may think about a like that we give to a certain product. We may think about something that our smart home device overheard while we were in the living room. All of those pieces of information are meaningless, both for us and for the entity that's receiving them. But the inference about them, that are sometimes about us, but sometimes about groups, are powerful and they're risky because they enable lots of things like making decisions about us, determining our credit score, using an AI to see whether someone's CV will get to a second stage. So that's the second thing. The first thing is that unlike in commercial interactions where we know how much we're giving up because we know how much money we're giving up, in data interactions, we don't know what we're giving up because we don't know the inferences and it's impossible for us to do. And the second significant difference is that giving that information implies giving power over us. Because based on that data, entities can make decisions about us, like our credit score, like whether our CV will make it to a second round, like whether we get a personal loan, for many people, whether they get bail on parole in a criminal process. So that shifts power dynamics in an extreme way that makes it completely unlike commercial interactions. And many of the solutions that we have, even the modern ones to address this, like, oh, let's break up big tech, doesn't make much of a difference if the interaction is the same. If I break up Facebook into 50 little Facebooks, and then they all have the same business model, I give my data to all of them, they could even trade my data on the back, that doesn't change my interaction with them that much. And the third difference is that unlike money, which is something restricted that I give, data is relational. Whenever I give data, I'm not only giving data about myself, I'm also giving data about lots of people that behave like me or look like me or speak like me, because just by the nature of inferences, most of them are made based on demographics and on shared behavior. So it's very different from a commercial system where my actions in a commercial system only affect me and not those around me.
What is an anti-privacy choice architecture? How does it work? How do we interact with it? And what's fundamentally the problem with it?
An anti-privacy choice architecture is a system design that nudges us not to making the choices that are best for us, but to making the choices that are best for a company. So you probably encountered when you found a cookie wall on some website, the choice of, do you want to accept cookies, yes or no? And we can talk about how that in itself is unhelpful. But many of the times that you saw that, you may have seen a big blue button that says yes, and then a small, almost transparent button that says no. So that's anti-privacy choice architecture. It's specifically designed to tilt you toward a certain choice that is not necessarily in your best interest. And the worst kind of anti-privacy architecture is what we call dark patterns. Dark patterns are mechanisms designed not only to nudge you away from the choices that are good for you, but to actively deceive you and make you make decisions in favor of a company that you wouldn't have made otherwise.
Begs the question, what should we do to fix these issues? And how much are the ultimate improvements in the hands of national governments versus international bodies or individual companies themselves?
Individual companies can do a lot. Individual companies that care about people's privacy or that care about managing people's data responsibly and developing AI products in a way that is sustainable can go a long way in improving this issue. They can choose to not use dark patterns and not use anti-privacy design. They can choose to do the opposite and try to design their products in ways that, for example, only collect the amount of information that they need to develop their product and not more than that, because that imposes risks on people's and on groups that are not necessarily offset by a new product that is developed. At an individual level, there's unfortunately not much that can be done, because the nature of inference and relational data means that even if we have a very good data hygiene, it is very difficult, or I would say impossible, to be able to prevent those sensitive inferences and to be able to prevent those spillover effects on others. So we could have best practices, but the unfortunate reality of encouraging people to do best practice that then we end up blaming people when something bad happens. Oh, your identity got stolen. You should have been more careful about where you put your credit card number. When we cannot put that on some people because it is not difficult, it is impossible for them to insulate themselves from all those risks. And at a government level, I think we can also do a lot. Governments can start thinking less about the different technical checkboxes that they can make companies go through, which are actually very expensive for companies, besides not being very helpful for people, and start thinking about substantive accountability mechanisms.
How do we balance some of the privacy reforms that you set out in the book with maintaining the entrepreneurial and innovative benefits of an open internet? Or is that the wrong way to even think about it?
I think that's a great question. It's not the wrong way to think about it. I think we need to be really careful and really attentive to maintaining an open internet and promoting innovation, because many of these technologies, and like particularly AI, do lots of wonderful things. They increase efficiency, they increase sustainability, and we should have a system that encourages that innovation while protecting people. One way to do that is an accountability system. Because the benefit of an accountability system is that it doesn't impose huge regulatory costs at the beginning. It doesn't tell companies, if you want to enter this market, you have to do all of these things that are really expensive. It also doesn't prevent new players from going in the market. Because the situations where companies would pay money is when they produce harm. So new companies that have safe data practices would have way better incentives to enter the market than they do now.
Are you optimistic that public policy is moving in the direction that you outline in the book?
I do. It's a difficult question because part of the answer depends on where. But I think that many of the conversations that we see about regulating AI start from a point of acknowledgement that inference are powerful, that inference are risky, that we cannot always anticipate what's a recipe that will insulate people from harm, that these harms are contextual, that they depend on lots of things, that we don't have a crystal ball to know exactly what will happen and how the technology will change. And that's a mistake that we consistently made with regulating data, and that I see people in power making less when regulating AI. So I am optimistic. I think the regulation of AI can go in that direction. And as we see that that works, then also it can go back and be the regulation of data more broadly.
To the extent that policymakers are listening to this conversation or persuaded by your analysis, are there jurisdictions around the world that they should be looking at as possible models to inform policymaking within their own jurisdiction?
Yes. So if you ask me, is any jurisdiction in the world doing exactly what you're recommending jurisdictions should do? The answer would be no. It is a new proposal that is different from what people are doing. Now, I think many jurisdictions get a large part of the way there. And one notable one is the GDPR and many of the applications of the GDPR by different national authorities. So the GDPR relies way less on individual consent than many other pieces of legislation for data protection and privacy, even many of them that are modeled after the GDPR itself. And that's significant progress, because that means that it puts less weight on individuals to protect themselves, and it has more mechanisms in the back that protect people even when they don't know it, matching the harms that they face even when they don't know it. And we can see that some of the most successful applications of the GDPR are from these principles that apply independent of people's individual action. Principles like data minimization, principles by data protection by design, have been more helpful than individual control mechanisms or individual consent mechanisms, because they operate systemically. So they reduce risk for everyone.
Well, that's a fascinating way to wrap up the conversation. The book is The Privacy Fallacy, Harm and Power in the Information Economy. Ignacio Caffoni, thank you so much for joining us at Hub Dialogues.
Thank you for having me. This is fun.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Hub Dialogues, brought to you by Hub Canada Media. Visit www.thehub.ca for daily analysis and insights into the big issues and ideas driving the public conversation. The Hub.ca gives you access to our original news reporting and the thinking of the Hub's best writers, including Sean Spear. While you're on the Hub.ca, consider clicking the join button. This will take you to the Hub's complimentary membership offer. Put in your email and you will receive each Saturday a compilation of the Hub's best writing and commentary from the week that was, along with all kinds of other terrific benefits. The host of today's program was Sean Spear, the Hub's editor at large. This episode was produced by Amal Atar Guzman. The Hub's audio producers are Alex Glutch and David Matta.